bulk, I doubt we'll ever see food prices so low again. I'm also pleased to tell you this approach to handling high food prices is catching on. Various American newspapers have reported housewives who are using the pantry as their personal store rather than going out and buying those ridiculously priced little packages, not to mention the horrible fast foods that drain out our pocketbooks. And I can tell you also from doing this, it's taken me 3 or 4 months to get a basic food supply in. So if you think that you're going to just go out at the last minute and grab some big bags of food, forget it. Those will all be cleaned off the shelves. And when I checked in these various places, they didn't have more in the storage room. It's a just-in-time food delivery service. So that puts us kind of at a risk, and I suggest you go out and get some now while the food is available. Last week, I ran into another local producer, radio producer, who lives in a semi-rural area close to our city. He said his family were so enthused by suggestions on this program, they talked to neighbors about it. Beyond the neighbors, they also had a network of families looking after developmentally challenged kids, the last people who should suffer if the supermarket shelves are suddenly emptied in a panic, or if food inflation becomes punitive. The result was an instant food co-op. 10 families agreed to pool $1,000 each to make a big bulk order. A local supermarket chain offered them food at cost, plus a tiny percent markup just for the handling. Another 40 individuals and families have expressed interest in buying in. The group has arranged storage spots for those without any cupboard space, and the whole thing has just taken off. That's just another example of the micro-networks of people I expect to spring up during this new depression. People who will work together rather than burrowing behind hidden walls with guns. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Who knows the future? I'm Alex Smith, and I don't. But I do feel better having food insurance, just as we have health insurance and car insurance.
Green swimmers can enjoy organic apples from New Zealand, organic oranges from Israel, organic flowers from Senegal, and organic cherries from Chile, all in the dead of winter. Who needs the Kyoto Protocol when we can shop against climate change?
I could spend a whole program on the ways you can economize and do without in the coming depression. We'll do that soon. In this program, we'll also touch on Plan B. You either decide to get out of Dodge, as they say, or are forced from your home by conditions beyond your control. Just wrapping up the homesteading at home idea, you also need to look around and see what natural food may be available. For example, we do have a salmon-bearing stream within walking distance of our place, believe it or not, and I suppose it would be possible to hunt for ducks around here. We take some time to learn about edible wild plants, where the mushrooms and the berries grow and all that. You'll need some energy in case the power grid goes splat. I have about 100 pounds of propane in various tanks, plus about a month's worth of wood out on our patio. There are boxes of candles in our pantry, plus some LED headlights and some wind-up flashlights. We're also blessed with a 50-watt solar panel and 2 deep-discharge batteries. I figure we could hang in for 3 months without power, but we still need some heavy insulated drapes to survive with just a fireplace in the winter months. We have lived that way before. It's tough, but not necessarily unpleasant. Please pay attention to this idea of a pulse economy. That means instead of regular services like water, electricity, food on demand, the new economy is more likely to come in waves. The power may be available for a few hours a day, like in most of the underdeveloped world. Food in particular naturally comes in waves along with nature's seasons. It makes total sense to buy lots of potatoes when they are cheap in October and store them in a cool but not frozen place where they can last at least until the following March. We did this year in our condo with a basement and noticed that the price of potatoes doubled by January. Money saved and potato security. You will learn when the rhubarb comes in, the asparagus, the green beans, and buy them by the bushel from farmers or at farmers' markets. Then pressure can them into glass sealer jars for the coming year. The same comes later in the summer for the fruits, which just need a dehydrator or a simple boiling water canner. Remember, you must have a pressure canner to preserve most vegetables, and certainly for cooked meals like stews and all meats. Home canned goods do not depend on freezer space or electricity at all. Many of these things are already cooked for you, so you have food to heat up over a fire if the gas or electricity goes out. Note that the power just came on in Arkansas this week, a full month after a freak ice storm in late January. That can happen anywhere, as it did in Quebec, Canada a few years ago. Ditto hurricanes and earthquakes. Well, not to speak of the global flu pandemic. I don't know whether that's ever going to happen. So you learn to harvest food when it comes. I expect industrial production will be the same way. Right now, the stores and the sales lots are full of excess goods that consumers are afraid or too broke to buy. That production will be sold off at sale prices. And that's the end of that consumer dream. The shippers who take raw materials to Chinese factories are parking their big freighters or going bankrupt. The factories are shutting down all over the world, including in North America, as demand slumps. It may be a decade before they start up again, if ever. I predict that things like socks and cooking pots will appear sporadically in the remaining outlet stores, exactly like life in the former Soviet Union. When things appear, you buy them if you can, adapting to the pulse of the economy and of the goods. You may end up bartering a lot of the time. We don't know what's going to happen to the value of our money. Speaking of comparisons to the Soviet Union, I highly recommend Dmitry Orlov's tips for surviving hard times. I also recommend his book, Reinventing Collapse, Soviet Example and American Prospects. It's very useful reading for those shocked to find themselves in the new depression. And he has free audio MP3s of his talks at that same blog. Also check out my Radio EcoShock interview with Dmitry Orlov at our website, ecoshock.org. That's in the show for May 30th, 2008, in our archive. We were way ahead of the time on that one. Here's a quick sample from that show, starting with a quote from Dmitry Orlov. In reflecting the process by which society as a whole, or at least the informed and thinking parts of it, is reconciling itself to the inevitability of a discontinuous future, with our institutions and life support systems undermined by a combination of resource depletion, catastrophic climate change, and political impotence. Well, here are the five stages.
Stage 1.
Financial collapse. Faith in business as usual is lost. The future is no longer assumed to resemble the past in any way that allows risk to be assessed and financial assets to be guaranteed. Financial institutions become insolvent. Savings are wiped out and access to capital is lost.
Stage 2.
Commercial collapse. Faith that the market shall provide is lost. Money is devalued and/or becomes scarce. Commodities are hoarded. Import and retail chains break down, and widespread shortages of survival necessities become the norm.
Stage 3.
Political collapse. Faith that the government will take care of you is lost. As official attempts to mitigate widespread loss of access to commercial sources of survival necessities fail to make a difference, the political establishment loses legitimacy and relevance.
Stage 4.
Social collapse. Faith that your people will take care of you is lost, as local social institutions, be they charities or other groups that rush in to fill the power vacuum, run out of resources, or fail through internal conflict.
Stage 5.
Cultural collapse. Faith in the goodness of humanity is lost. People lose their capacity for kindness, generosity, consideration, affection, honesty, hospitality, compassion, and charity. That's a quote from Turnbull, the mountain people. Families disband and compete as individuals for scarce resources. The new motto becomes, may you die today so that I die tomorrow. That's from Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago. There may even be some cannibalism, end quote from Dmitry Orlov. Now, Orlov doesn't predict cannibalism as a future for America. He just says some societies have reached terrible stages, and he gives examples in his book from the dislocated African tribe described in another book, The Mountain People, by Colin M. Turnbull. Hopefully, by learning from previous cases of collapse, we can learn how to do better as individuals and as a society. But we shouldn't wait until things drop down to the bottom, to the pit of collapse. I'm Alex Smith, and we've been covering ideas to enhance your survival right where you are. But in the longer term, is it really time to look for a better place to live? How friendly will your city be when the riots hit? How defensible is your little hideaway in town? Will rising seas overwhelm your real estate? What about wildfires driven by killer heat waves? Maybe you were ready for eco-migration. It came out recently that Baron Nicholas Stern, former chief World Bank economist and author of the British Stern Report, expects mass refugees due to climate change. Charles Hanley of the Associated Press said that without significant carbon controls, Stern expects climate change to, quote, transform where people can live. People would move on a massive scale. Hundreds of millions, probably billions of people would have to move if you talk about 4, 5, 6 degree increases. Stern is talking about 7 to 10 degree Fahrenheit, and likely local, if not global, wars because, quote, there's no way the world can handle that kind of population move in the time period in which it would take place, end quote. Most of the billions who will be forced to move are in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. They will go toward the cooler areas and the water. That means either the remaining wet tropics, but more likely, like the birds and the fish, toward the poles. Welcome to Siberia, Scandinavia, New Zealand, or Canada, the new, most populous countries in a climate-damaged world. We are honored to have one of the world's top experts on eco-migration with us on Radio EcoShock. Dr. Norman Myers is currently a professor at Green College, Oxford, and a visiting professor at many other prestigious universities. He has advised world leaders, published 19 books, and is known for pioneering research into new problems. He is one of only two persons worldwide to receive all three leading environmental prizes from UNEP, plus the Volvo Environment and Blue Planet prizes. Dr. Myers, welcome.
Thank you. Very glad to be with you.
Can we start with a short explanation of what eco-migration is?
Yes, it's a term that has come into fairly widespread use in the last few years. After I defined eco-migration in 1993 as referring to those people who, here we go, find themselves obliged to leave their long-time residence area for reasons largely environmental, but also including additional factors such as poverty, population pressures, and so on. These people leave their usual habitats because they feel compelled to do so. They do not move at all out of choice. So they are quite unlike the economic opportunists who number maybe 200 million, whereas the environmental refugees, environmental migrants, as I call them, total only, well, less than 50 million. Does that respond to your question?
It does indeed, and I want to ask you, is climate disruption becoming a bigger driver of eco-migration versus simple pollution, say, or things like overgrazing?
Oh, yes, yes. Overgrazing, desertification, deforestation, water shortages, things of that sort, have been quite a significant problem. You see, if there are 50 million of these people, that's, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's twice as many people as you have in the whole of Canada. So it's a pretty big phenomenon, and that in itself is growing quite rapidly. But climate refugees, a kind of subset of environmental refugees, will, according to some calculations I did half a dozen years ago, leave us with the prospect of maybe about 220 million people could, and according to the IPCC, could surge to as many as half a billion people by 2050 or so. This is a much, much larger environmental problem than we've seen so far. But don't let's be altogether downside. This is not only a problem, but it is also a massive opportunity. We still have time, though only just enough time, to do a great deal to reduce the unprecedented damage that climate change will otherwise cause.
Where are the biggest eco-migrations happening so far?
Within the compass of sub-Saharan Africa, there's a lot there. And a lot have been threatened or overtaken by storm surges in coastal zones, hurricanes. And that applies especially in the Bay of Bengal, the Nile Delta, the eastern coastal areas of both China and India. Also quite a lot in, you see, there's quite a big migration from Mexico into the United States. And some of these people, only some, but a significant proportion of these people, are driven by environmental factors as opposed to economic opportunity.
Well, surely big think tanks and the world military are looking closely at eco-migration as one of the great problems of the century. Is this a growing field of research, and what tools can we apply to find out more?
It is a growing field. Thank goodness at last, at long last. I mentioned earlier that my original report was dated 1993, and for the first 10 years, the amount of action that we saw from governments and international agencies was, and I choose my word carefully, virtually nil, for various reasons of institutional inertia, political inclination to look the other way, a good deal of ignorance, if not ignorance, on the part of big business.
Well, the question is, what tools can we use to find out more about this now that we've identified it?
I think that the main response to try to counter this massive phenomenon of environmental refugees is to address the causes of the migration. Hitherto, we've tended to address the symptoms of the problem, and we should go to the sources of the problem and ask ourselves, why do these people feel so driven to migrate in the first place, and what can we do to relieve that compulsive pressure? And that means that we must phase out the motivation that these people have to migrate, and in turn, that means pursuing what is known in the trade as sustainable development. We must enable these people to enjoy lifestyles that are acceptable, sustainable, and that means looking at water supplies, in particular in various parts of the world, tackling soil erosion, grand-scale pollution of various sorts, problems of that sort. Now, we know what to do. We have enough science and technological research. We know what to do, and we have the technologies to do the necessary. And we've found by experience that it will not cost the Earth to save the Earth. On the contrary, it'll often put money into our pockets. But what we need, the resource in shorter supply right now, is not money or scientific understanding. It is political leadership, of which there is a woeful dearth.
Well, what should we be doing? I mean, for example, I've heard some people say in Britain, perhaps Britain should be setting up a stronger hospital system and prepare for more schools, because people will be coming from North Africa and various places where the deserts are expanding or drying out, and Britain and Scandinavia may have to pick up some of the load.
We should certainly be doing that on purely humanitarian grounds, but in terms of trying to get on top of this problem before it gets on top of us, those measures you've mentioned won't go very far at all. This is not, repeat, not to decry those efforts, but in terms of reducing the overall problem, they won't go very far at all. We're already sorely late. If we got on with the job 10 or 15 years ago, we could have done a lot to relieve the plight of these migrants, but as it is, we've got a heck of a task on now because there's so much climate change in the pipeline.
I'd like to pick your mind for a second about China. I've been told that there are about 400 million people in the north of China experiencing a severe drought, while in the south, extreme storms have damaged some of the crops. I'm wondering, could we picture a world in which the Chinese move north into Siberia if the climate does shift, if we can't get things under control?
Oh, wow. That's a real big one, because I don't suppose the Russians would stand by idly and watch millions of Chinese cross the border. That's why this issue is being addressed by military agencies, security agencies. But you're quite right. The northern half of China, where one third of the grain crop of the wheat crop is grown, is very short of water, and it's getting a lot shorter. In the southern half of China, there's in some places a surplus of water, and that's why the Chinese are investing huge amounts of money to build great pipelines from the Yangtze River into the northern sector. But again, that is tackling symptoms of the problem and not getting at the source of the problem. We should ask, well, why has this problem arisen in the first place? Why wasn't it tackled earlier? What are the political roadblocks that have prevented action thus far? The questions you're raising are very excellent questions in my view, and I'm wondering if I'm giving answers that are sufficiently substantive and pointed and on target.
Oh, I think so. You're one of the preeminent experts in this field. You know, I'm thinking too about people in Australia are more aware of this problem because of the South Sea Islanders are already planning their move as rising seas will displace some of their countries. But here in North America, we really don't hear about eco-refugees. It's just not a topic of discussion. And I'm wondering, why should North Americans tune into this problem?
Well, I think they should stick around and stay tuned, frankly. the agricultural basis of North America's security, stability, prosperity, and so on is under quite severe threat in a globally warmed world. There'll be lots and lots of people flooding into the United States from Mexico and the Caribbean and other parts of Latin America. And to think that this tidal wave of migrants can be held back by building a big fence along the southern border of the United States is, well, it helps, but that's all. And what has been a trickle has become somewhat of a stream. The stream will become a flood, and the flood will, according to the IPCC and others, within a decade or so, become a torrent.
Yes, I can remember back in grade school learning Latin, and one of the things that we learned was about how the Roman guards were absolutely unable to stop the German masses, hundreds of thousands of people coming with all their possessions, just coming through every forest and stream there was. You really can't build a fence against that sort of event.
No, you certainly can't, just as you can't launch fighter planes against advancing desert. Let me just mention very briefly, if I can compress the point, that the way you said about Chinese flooding into Russia. There was a day when Russia and China went to war, and after the first day, the Russians had taken 1 million prisoners and said, "Do you want to give up?" The Chinese said no. By the third day, the Russians had taken 5 million prisoners and said to the Chinese, "Do you want to give up?" And the Chinese said no. "Do you want to give up?"
Oh, dear. Well, as we wrap up, are there any parting points that you'd like to make, or perhaps even a website or an institution that listeners who want to follow up more could go to?
Well, the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has a great deal of detail on the mechanisms of climate change, what is causing it, how far it's gone already, how far is there momentum already built into the system that we must look at. But above all, we must do much, much more to acknowledge that this is a major problem, quite unprecedented since we came out of our caves, unprecedented in scale and size and character. It's going to be one of the biggest shocks, or rather, let's be a bit positive and say one of the biggest challenges that humankind has ever had to tackle in the past. And it may finally help us to acknowledge that we do really live on a single planet, and we must try to make room for all inhabitants, no matter where they might be or where they've come from.
Dr. Norman Myers, thank you so much for your time. Currently a professor at Oxford, that was one of the world's top experts on environmental problems and possibly the founder of the study of eco-migration. What a gift that scientists are so generous with their time. Check out the article by Dankar Vedantam in the Washington Post, February 23rd. The title is, "Climate Fears Are Driving Eco-Migration Across the Globe." In the story, an American couple from Montgomery County decide to move to New Zealand, hoping to provide a safer climate for their two children. Many more of our American listeners will decide to move north to Canada. It's pretty easy. Perhaps we'll do a show on what that means, the hoops you have to jump for immigration. But in the longer run, I expect an unstoppable march in migration from the United States north following the rain, looking for cooler temperatures and places where crops will still grow, the new northern temperate zones. While all the world can see the climate shifting, we still have lots of congressmen and senators left over who just don't get it. Listen to this Texas congressman at last week's hearings of the Subcommittee on Energy and the Environment.
The chair recognizes the ranking member of the full committee, the gentleman from Texas.
I am, I don't think it's a surprise, a skeptic that mankind is causing the climate to change. I do agree that the climate is changing. That's self-evident. I just have a problem because I'm a registered professional engineer. When I look at all the evidence of the past climate change cycles to see what's different about this one, that somehow mankind is the cause. We understand that global warming is a theory, and it may even be a practical theory, but I'm not yet ready to accept that it's a theology. And some of the more fervent global warming advocates do take it as a theology or a pseudo-religion. When you try to debate with them the facts of the case, they get very intensely upset.
I don't know how Chairman Ed Markey, who really does get it, how he can sit there so patiently listening to the flat earthers say that our huge industrial exhaust has nothing to do with climate change. I guess there's still lots of oil and coal lobby money for campaign funds for these deniers. At least the Texans have stopped denying climate change exists, perhaps after Hurricane Ike and Galveston. Worse, I keep finding comments from the right-wing bloggers saying, oh, well, there's always been climate change. Nothing we can do. Yes, there have been hothouse worlds which developed over long time periods, millions of years, not a couple of hundred years, and everybody larger than a mouse died. Or how about this spiritual cable TV host who thinks that the Earth just wants to be warm?
The Earth is in a cycle as a great being herself. Yes. We, humans, are really an extension of the Earth, so I don't think we're doing anything that the Earth itself doesn't want done. So maybe we're supposed to raise the temperatures and the Earth will go through its next phase. Maybe we're assisting that level of consciousness of what the Earth is. So what I really want to talk about is this consciousness of Earth as a Gaia, as a being, and how does that fit into what people say is global warming and consciousness?
Yeah, the seasons we knew were just tired. Earth was ready for a change. Our stupidity of hauling out millions of years of concentrated solar energy to drive to the Dairy Queen is Gaia's will. That's when I need to practice my belly breathing. It's a technique I picked up recently to focus on the body's breath and release stress. We'll all need something to keep our cool while everyone around us is losing theirs.
Let's wind up the troops.
You are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months.
Oh, what fun and adventure we have ahead of us. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Go ahead and steal a bunch of MP3s from our free website at ecoshock.org. Load up your iPod, computer, or CD player and get ready, because the change is upon us.
Radio EcoShock.
Life after the crash. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock, first broadcast in 2009. There is lots more crisis radio coming up, including growing your own groceries in hard times. Is the mass pyramid scheme of hypermodern life unraveling? Good luck to us all. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. Take care of one another.
Go!
Hi, it's Nardwar, the human serviette, saying you're listening to CJSF Burnaby and Doo-Doo-Loo-Doo CJSF. Yeah.
This is Bird Note. Sandpipers, like these sanderlings at the beach, are hunched over, probing industriously, as if drilling for oil. But sandpiper bills are far more than drills. Many sandpipers have sensitive nerve receptors in their bill tips, so they can find unseen prey through touch, odor, and pressure changes. And so, they feed even at night. The variety of bill sizes and shapes among the sandpipers is astounding. The long-billed curlew sports a slender, down-curved bill that may reach 9 inches long. With such a tool, the curlew can probe deeply in the mud for marine worms or snatch a grasshopper from deep in the grass. At the other extreme of bill length, the turnstone lives up to its name. Using its short, stout bill as a crowbar, a turnstone turns aside rocks and mats of dried seaweed in search of small crustaceans. Those sandpipers with long, straight bills, such as dowitchers, are often described as stitching. As the bird probes for food, its beak moves rapidly up and down like the needle on a sewing machine. April brings many thousands of sandpipers to Delaware Bay on the Atlantic coast and Grays Harbor and San Pablo Bay on the Pacific. These and other such wildlife refuges are crucial to the migration of these fascinating birds. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.